Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Yo, technology, what is it all about?
When Marc Andreessen created Netscape, the internet browser that ignited the dot-com boom, the world was a very different place. Just 20 million people were connected to what was more popularly known way back in 1994 as the World Wide Web. It was so primitive that most people had to log on, download their email, and then log off. Continuous connection was a luxury few people had. Today, 23 years on, nearly half the planet is online, and entire industries are being swept aside by the great leveling power of the internet. But that was only chapter one. So what happens next? Where do we go from here? This week on Danny in the Valley, we have brought on none other than Marc Andreessen himself to do some future gazing with us.
If you can tell what's a cat in a photo, then, by the way, then maybe you can tell what's a tumor in an MRI, right, better than a person, right, which, right, of course, would have enormous significance, right, for healthcare.
Today, Marc is one of Silicon Valley's most prominent venture capitalists. He's a founding partner of the venture capital firm Andreessen Horowitz, which has invested in more than 150 companies, including Facebook, Airbnb, and Twitter. Marc personally was one of the first investors in Facebook and remains a director on the social media giant's board, as well as a trusted advisor to Mark Zuckerberg. So we cover a lot of ground, from everything from why he told a 22-year-old Zuckerberg way back in 2006 to turn down a blockbuster $1 billion takeover from the giant of the time, Yahoo. We talk about tech's next big targets for disruption and how the internet has evolved beyond all recognition. But before we get to that, two very quick points of housekeeping. One, a recommendation. Check out the Sunday Times Magazine podcast, which, if you haven't already listened to it or subscribed, is very good. And for my listeners, I think you'll find it very interesting this week in particular because the magazine is publishing its special tech issue, which is where my interview with Marc appears, as well as loads of other great stuff. So do check that out. And also, wanted to give you a heads up. Next week, we have another special guest coming on. I'm not going to say who it is, but I'll give you a hint. He's very excitable, and he's one of the richest men on planet Earth. I think you'll really dig that. But right now, let's get to Marc Andreessen.
I don't know if you ever heard the term store and forward.
Nope.
Okay, so the way this stuff used to work is you didn't have persistent connections. You would connect to the internet, you would like download your email, and you would log off. And so a lot of people had these kind of partial connections because it was too expensive. At the time, it was too expensive. The telecom charges were so high that it was too expensive to keep a line open all the time. And so like people had email like that, but it wasn't really on the internet and that they couldn't necessarily do anything. Right. Well, so specifically where I got lucky was when I went to University of Illinois, and I started in 89. So, and did my work there from 89 to 93. They had just been funded in the late 80s to be one of four national supercomputer centers. Right, so this is the whole thing Al Gore got in trouble for that actually turned out.
Oh, he invented the internet.
Well, this is actually where he got in trouble. So I'll defend Al for a second. Okay. So he never said he invented the internet. He said he created the internet. He participated in the creation of the internet. And the part of that is true is that he and the Senate sponsored the bills that funded the National Supercomputer Centers. And then the National Supercomputer Centers were the backbone nodes for what was at the time called the NSFNet, which was the first thing that you would today say that was the internet, right? That was the modern internet, was the NSFNet turned into the internet. And specifically, I bring up the supercomputers because the whole thing was an economics play on the cost of these supercomputers, which is you'd buy these supercomputers for $20, $30 million. You would literally put them in their own buildings. Like they were so big that you would actually build a building for the computer. You would not complete the roof, and then you would actually lower the computer by a crane into the core of the building, and then you would finish the roof, right? That was like, that's how big and expensive these things were.
And that was probably as powerful as what?
That's your iPhone. That's your iPhone. That's your $600 iPhone in your pocket is that today. It's exactly the same. But by the way, both running Unix. The supercomputers run Unix. Right. Your iPhone runs Unix. Your iPhone literally is a Unix supercomputer that cost $30 million 25 years ago in your pocket. So anyway, so that was so expensive that they could only do those in a few universities. But there were scientists all over the country that they wanted to give access to these computers. And so that was the NSFNet, was National Science Foundation funded the network so that scientists remotely could access these computers. And so at Illinois in like 89, we had like fully modern, we had broadband, we were on the internet backbone, we had broadband, they were wiring up all the dorms, they were wiring up all the libraries, we had graphics workstations, we had, you know, Silicon Graphics made these $50,000 workstations that were equivalent for what you get today on a $200, you know, Chromebook.
Right.
We had all this stuff and it just worked. And then we had these supercomputers and then we had scientists all over the country and the world using these computers. And then the group that I was in was building software to enable the scientists to more effectively use these remote computers shared.
And that is what eventually rolled into what became Netscape.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so it was one of those funny things because you could see it. William Gibson has this great line, which is the future's already here. It's just not widely distributed yet. And so you could see what it was going to be if you were on campus at the University of Illinois. But the assumption that everybody had was when you left campus, that was it. You were done. Like this was like an academic.
So if you were like University of Kansas, could you have ended up being something entirely different?
So actually, it's interesting. Actually, we had a guy actually on the Netscape founding engineering team from the University of Kansas. Right. And actually, it's funny. This is actually a very relevant part of the story. So he's a guy named Lou Montulli. So he actually had built a text-based browser called Lynx. And so the University of Kansas was on the internet, but with a much slower connection. And so the connection that they were on the internet with, you couldn't do graphical browsing because it didn't have enough bandwidth. And so he actually built a browser so you could browse in like a text or DOS-based interface. And that was how,
right.
Like in, you know, University of Kansas, like big school, like even there and at places like that, you still didn't have what you would consider to be modern access. So maybe, I don't know, 2 or 3 million people at the time maybe had what you would consider to be internet access today. And then another, I don't know, 15 million or something on some form of kludgy hacked up email thing. Also, it was the numbers, but it was also not even the numbers. It was just the assumption that this was for academics and nerds, military contractors. But this was these things were not things that you would ever expect ordinary people to do.
So 2017, we're now, say, 3.5 billion people on the internet. Everybody has these little supercomputers in their pockets.
About 60% of adults on the globe have a supercomputer in their pocket at this point. On its way to 100%.
So is the internet today what you thought it would be then?
It's leaps and bounds beyond anything that I think anybody imagined. I mean, it's way, way beyond.
What has been?
I mean, we had a general sense that people would want this, but that there's a big difference between having that general sense and then seeing what's actually happening today.
What's been the biggest surprise in terms of the direction it has gone or what it has allowed?
I mean, it's actually kind of funny how quickly you take these things for granted. So the idea... When you were a kid, did you ever read the book Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
I did.
Yeah. Did you ever think that the actual Hitchhiker's Guide would ever actually be a real thing that people would have?
No.
No. Not only do we have that today, and it's called Google, and it's called Wikipedia, and it's called YouTube, like we have that, but like we have that and the company that built it, which is basically, or Google basically is the company that kind of built, you know, in other words, like I want to know something out of Google. I ask a question, it gives me the answer, like the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. The fact that not only do we have that, but that it's worth like $500 billion. It's just relative to what we all thought. I mean, it's just absurd and is amazing. And then the idea, you know, even just the idea of Facebook, right? The idea that you would have this, you know, giant network that you'd have this giant. I mean, we all had yearbooks in high school. And
oh yeah, I still have some.
And like the idea that would be the foundational idea for what would become another company worth $500 billion that would be connecting together 2 billion people every day. Like,
yeah,
it's absurd. And yet
it is totally absurd.
And here we are. And now everybody's like, oh yeah, of course. Like, you know. Absolutely. Right. So like, and there's just like, you know, we could sit here and go for, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of these. I mean, the idea of a global bazaar, right? The idea of an eBay, right? Or the idea of an Alibaba. I mean, you may remember, I mean, how insane the idea of eBay was the first time people heard about it, right? Mm. Which is like, I'm going to buy something from somebody I've never met. When eBay first launched, I'm going to go to the post office and buy a money order, which is how you paid in the early days of eBay.
It was money orders.
It was money orders. PayPal didn't exist yet. And there, you couldn't do the transactions online. So I'm going to buy a money order. I'm going to mail the money order to this person I've never met. And in return, they're going to mail me back the thing that I bought. Like, seriously? And right today, it's just like, today it's just like, this is how, you know, modern, you know, the upgraded version of that is how modern commerce operates, to the point where traditional retail is, you know, going through significant challenges to, you know, to adapt to that. So, you know, that's a complete surprise.
Yeah, well, it's amazing if you look at what's happening in retail now. The economy is growing. Retail, traditional retail, is just contracting at an incredible rate. Yeah. It's just all, you know, you have ghost malls. In the UK, you have kind of high streets that are, every other place now is empty. Mm-hmm. You kind of wonder, well, where's this all going? And also the millennial desire and demand for everything. I want, you know, it's Amazon has taught us to expect something the next day.
Yeah. So when I was a kid, there was a concept called mail order, which was the precursor to e-commerce. And right, you would see an infomercial on TV, or you would read a classified, an ad in a magazine, and you'd order something. And so what you would do is you'd mail a check. And then it always at the bottom, it always said, please wait 4 to 6 weeks for delivery, was always what it said. Right. And in trade practice, it was always 6 weeks. And like 6 weeks later, your thing would arrive. And it was always like 6 weeks. Like, what on earth are people doing with the other 5 weeks and 6 days? Like what? But like the expectation was just right. The expectation was super low. And now to exactly your point, like that's come exactly 180 degrees around, where now it's like, well, same day is starting to feel lazy. Right. It's like, well, what's, you know, Amazon's trying to get it down to same hour. Right. And by the way, right. Yeah. Fundamental challenge, even in e-commerce, right. If you can't get this thing down to an hour or two, right. At some point,
that's even
the other e-commerce companies. Yeah. Right. And then literally to the point where like, they're going to fly the thing to you from a drone. Yeah. I mean, wow.
Yeah.
Right. We funded a great company that has, basically building R2-D2, little delivery robots. Right. And so, the little navigation bot for the little bots. Actually a delivery bot. The little bot goes down the sidewalk and trundles along, because you don't need to figure out all the air issues. You just do it on the sidewalk.
Right.
And it just brings you your package or brings you your sandwich or whatever. And it's like, yeah, it's actually funny. That's actually a funny story. So that company, they originally developed the product in China. They went to Shenzhen to kind of totally understand the supply chain in China, and so they were prototyping the product in China. And so they were worried. They told us this story. They were worried that people would be freaked out by the idea of like they're walking down the street and there's like a delivery robot like trundling by, and like what on earth is this thing? And so they did all these like candid camera like things where they would basically just take this prototype bot and like run it like through a park. The footage is hysterical, because people are like, they kind of turn, they see it, and it's kind of trundling along, and they see it, and they kind of stare at it for a second, and you can see the conflicting look on their face, because on the one hand, they're like, okay, that's weird, and then on the other hand, they're like, but that's probably normal, and I just didn't know about it, and then they're like, okay, and then they just go back to what they're doing, right? And so, I mean, I think we're gonna like adapt to that idea actually quite quickly.
Is it harder to do your job today than it was when you first started investing, whenever it was, 10 odd years ago?
How so?
In that the infrastructure now, like during the last crash, you had all these companies promising to change the world, but none of them could because the infrastructure wasn't in place.
Well, some of them did.
Of course.
Some of them worked.
Many didn't, let's say.
That's true.
But now you do have, you know, super cheap computing, a supercomputer in your pocket. You have very fast connections. And all these, you know, Amazon Web Services and things that allow you to start a company in a way it's easier than ever to start a company, which I would imagine means separating the wheat from the chaff is harder.
Yeah. So what's happened is the basic cost of starting an internet company, it's fallen from maybe $20 million of upfront capital to, I mean, certainly down to at least $500,000. And actually, you see a meaningful number of companies now where they're started on basically no capital. It's basically through, you know, 2, 3, 4 people. It's their laptops that they probably already owned. And then they have like a $100 bill from Amazon Web Services. And like, that's their launch cost. And so what's the CapEx? We actually invested in one company where the entire invested capital in the life of the company had been
$7.
$7. Because it turns out it still costs $7 to buy a domain name.
What was that company doing?
Imgur. It's actually the company Imgur. Imgur, which is image hosting, this huge giant image hosting and image community thing. It's this huge thing now. But literally, his entire invested capital. He started it in his dorm room when he was in college, and he was frustrated because he couldn't figure out how to buy a domain name for $6. Right? It took a whole seven. So it's dramatic. You know, it's a dramatic deflation of the entry costs. The consequence of that, you know, to your question, the consequence is just people are just starting a lot more companies, right? So which is a natural consequence, right? Sort of supply and demand. The way I would describe that is Darwin has kicked in, right? And so basically the way I think about it is every entrepreneurial experiment you can imagine on the internet is being tried. It's actually funny. It's actually they're being tried, and then if they don't work, like some, you know, a bunch of people will try an idea, like different companies will try an idea, and then if it doesn't work, then like a bunch of those companies go away or whatever. And then 2 years later, there's a bunch of new companies that then try the same idea, and they basically just like come in waves until eventually somebody gets it to work. So I would just describe it as basically just like a superheated Darwinian environment. From a venture capital standpoint, the super positive part of that is we benefit from the other side of that, right? Which is the companies, many more experiments being run, so many more candidates for companies that can become great venture-backed companies. And then we basically get to see this whole kind of Darwinian process play out. And then obviously we're doing our best to try to
But that Darwinian process plays out that early on in their life?
Oh, yeah, in the first year and a half, 2 years. I mean, well, for the first stage. I mean, there's later. Right. You're still, you know, you're competing your whole life one way or another. But, you know, that basic process of figuring out. So, and specifically for what we do, the way we think about it, we use this term called product market fit.
Yeah.
So the way we think about it basically is the companies fundamentally exist in two stages. One is pre-product market fit, and that's when they're basically just trying to figure out what to build and whether anybody wants it. And then there's post-product market fit, which is they have a product, they've identified a market for the product, and there's evidence that the market wants the product. Now, there's a whole new set of challenges that happen after product market fit that are the ones that we tend to work with them on. But, you know, the motto at Y Combinator is the t-shirts they give out is, you know, build something people want. And on the one hand, that sounds like, you know, duh, obvious. But it's just, it's really profoundly significant what happens at a company when you go from not knowing whether you have something that people want to going to having something people want. In many ways, the ideal point of investment in venture capital is right when they figured out that they actually have something that people want.
And then, so before it takes off.
Number one, before it takes off. But number two is just at that point, then there's a whole new level of work that's required to build the company around the product, right? To build the sales force and to build the whole how to actually take care of customers and how to scale globally and how to do marketing. And then there's all these other things, finance and legal and HR and all these other aspects of how you build companies, management, executive team, like all these things. And that's really where VC, I think, actually becomes highly valuable to these companies. And so if you're in the business of investing post-product market fit, then you want as many experiments being run pre-product market fit as you possibly can.
Can we talk about AI?
Sure, yeah.
So I lived here for 15 years ago, and then I went to Europe, and then I just came back. And in 2000, everybody was a .com. They just put .com on their name and raised a bunch of money.
Yeah.
Now people are putting .ai or .io or whatever and raising a bunch of money.
Yeah.
Do you think there is a bubble around quote-unquote AI, artificial intelligence, and do you subscribe to the idea that this will become the kind of new electricity, that it will just be, it'll be everywhere, and it'll be in all our devices and kind of handle a lot of the tasks that today dumb machines or humans handle?
Right. So you may know the history of AI. So AI is an idea that traces all the way back to the invention of the computer. So it traces all the way back to Alan Turing and Claude Shannon and these guys and John von Neumann in the early 40s. There have actually been a series of kind of AI booms along the way, sort of the 50s, 60s, 70s. And when I went to college, 89, when I got to Illinois, actually the AI boom of the 80s had just fizzled, had just collapsed. And AI actually had been deeply, deeply discredited. If you read the media accounts at the time in the mid-80s, it was this AI revolution that was underway. Actually, it's funny. The two things that everybody knew for a fact in like 1987 in tech were, number one, AI is the future of everything. And number two is Japan is going to own the entire world. Like, and actually, the Japanese actually had a specific project they called Fifth Generation Computing that they were sponsoring that was actually going to develop the AI mainframe that was going to just take over the entire tech industry. And everybody was absolutely freaked out and terrified. And the politicians were going nuts. And, you know, Ross Perot ran for president. Like the whole, you know, everybody was just in a complete frenzy over this stuff. you know, there were sort of interesting kind of things every step of the way, but the promise was never really delivered. Like, it never really quite worked.
Because AI back then, what was that? Just like a really smart calculator?
Well, they were trying to do things like a big term in the 80s was this thing called expert systems. And so it was kind of this thing of like automated medical diagnosis was something they talked about a lot. And the idea was basically that you would train, basically trying to train computers on how to do common sense. And so it was actually they had these huge projects at the time to try to basically like train a computer. You know, they're like teach a computer English, right? And like, you know, teach a computer English and be able to, you know, disambiguate all the different weird, you know, the words that are spelled the same but sound different in different contexts. And all the different metaphors, and they had these giant projects to kind of try to encode all human knowledge and get a computer to do it. And it never really quite worked. And so actually, AI actually got deeply discredited as a field. And actually, when I was in college, AI was like, if you worked on AI, you basically didn't talk about it because you'd get laughed at, right? And so like it got really bad, it got really dark. And then actually, it stayed dark as a field, you know, really through the early 2000s. The Google guys came out of the AI group at Stanford, and they always believed in it, but they hired a lot of the people early on, to their credit. But it was a very, very, but there wasn't also, by the way, like there wasn't, it's not like there was a lot of AI in what Google did at the time. It's just these guys kind of thought that it would happen at some point, which it has. It was still kind of dormant through the 2000s. It was really 2012 when it felt like something changed. And the specific thing that changed was there's a test for testing AI algorithms called ImageNet, which is sort of this industry kind of academic kind of competition that they do. There's actually a computer science professor at Stanford.
This is a Stanford thing, right?
Yeah, Fei-Fei, who's also we've done a lot of work with, who kind of organized this whole thing. And so ImageNet is this very interesting kind of test, which is computers recognizing what objects and images are and what they're not, right? And so the famous version of the test is, because it's the internet now, it's recognizing cats, right? And so is it a cat or is it a cinnamon bun, right? And it's like with a human being looks at a photo and it's like, is it a cat or a cinnamon bun? It's obviously a cat. When a computer looks at it, and it's like, turns out cats and cinnamon buns actually look a lot alike. And so historically, you know, computers would have, I don't know, a 30 or 40% success rate of successful identification of cat versus cinnamon bun versus a human. ImageNet, I think.
Was it actually a cinnamon bun?
Or whatever.
Okay. I just didn't know if there was a, like, okay, we're going to compare it to a cinnamon
bun. Or whatever's in the photo, right? Whatever's in the photo, right? Right. Whatever's in the photo. Or is it a cat or a ferret? Or is it a cat or a photo of a cat? You know, or a poster of a cat on a wall? Or is it, you know, it's all these things where, as a human, you just have kind of the judgment and context to be able to tell these things. As a computer, computers are hyper-literal. And so if they don't, historically at least, the way computers traditionally work is if there's anything even a little bit off, right, computers just kind of don't know what to do. In 2012, I think, was when actually computers passed humans in terms of being able to disambiguate objects and photos, right? And so then you say, well, okay, so it's pretty significant, right? If you can tell what's a cat in a photo, then, by the way, then maybe you can tell what's a tumor in an MRI, right, better than a person, right? Which, of course, would have enormous significance, right, for healthcare. Or if you can do that, maybe you can detect cancer in a blood biopsy, right? To be able to do a whole new kinds of cancer diagnostic because it's the same kind of technology. Or maybe you can do, maybe instead of just doing a one-time recognition of a photo, maybe you can actually look at images 30 times a second, and then you can be the brain of a self-driving car. And then when a, you know, kid runs across the road, you can disambiguate between, oh, it's a kid versus it's a plastic bag that kind of looks like a kid.
Right.
Right. In which case, as a car driving 70 miles an hour, you want to have two totally different responses if it's a kid or a plastic bag. And so all of a sudden, it kind of felt, the world kind of turned on its end in computer science, and basically people were like, oh, now we seem to have figured out, it's basically a set of algorithms, a new way to kind of collect and deal with data, and then just raw computing horsepower has advanced so much. And so it's some combination of those three things really changed, and that unlocked what has become this kind of current frenzy around AI. And so we're seeing a flood of, I mean, basically a huge number of companies, kind of to your point, coming through here. AI applied to, let's figure out a better way to do risk scoring for providing credit or for doing insurance. Let's use AI to try to find out a way to gather, you know, heartbeat data off an Apple Watch and be able to see if we can maybe predict heart attacks before they happen. Let's figure out for the cancer biopsy. Let's figure out if we can actually do genomic sequencing of traces of tumors in blood and then actually use machine learning to go in and figure out if somebody actually has cancer and what the state of the cancer is. Self-driving cars, self-flying drones, right? The delivery drones, like they want to be able to fly themselves.
So you don't think this will be another expert systems crash.
So this is what is so entertaining about the current public debate over AI, which is you basically have...
Elon Musk says we're going to be killed by smart...
Yes.
A fleet of smart robots who are very mean.
So Elon and Bill Gates and Stephen Hawking are all in a complete panic because they think that this technology now works so well and it's going to hyper-accelerate and these things are going to wake up and be evil and kill us all or take all our jobs or whatever the hell it is. Like, it's just all going to be terrible. But it's going to be a consequence of the technology working so well, right? Whereas all the actual AI people are like, shit, I hope we could deliver on it this time. Like, right?
I'm hoping for the robot apocalypse.
I'm hoping to not be humiliated and embarrassed by a complete collapse of the field again.
Right.
Right. And so they're all just basically, and by the way, it's actually really funny. They actually get really mad. They're not super outgoing people, and so they don't talk as much in public as Elon does, but they get super frustrated at what Elon's doing, both because they just think he's wrong, because they think he just doesn't know what he's talking about, but they also get frustrating because he's setting the expectations for what they're expected to be to deliver so high. That they're actually
well, I think it's also odd because is not his car.
Yes. Well, I call that his,
a smart robot.
Yeah.
An AI powered robot.
Well, I suggested to him on Twitter that he name it the AI murder machine.
How did he take that?
The road murder machine. He deleted the entire conversation. He didn't like that one as much as some of my other suggestions. He is. Yeah, no, it's actually really funny. He's trying to hire as many AI experts as he can to literally build AI. Well, he's funding this thing, OpenAI.
Yes.
This whole institute, this research institute to build AI. So it's kind of a sign of the times, right, which is sort of, there's kind of two fundamental critiques of tech right now, right? One is it's all just completely worthless and stupid, right? And it's a bubble and it's all just, you know, these kids.
App after app,
like whatever. It's a joke, right? It's a bubble and it's going to crash. And the other fear is, oh my God, it's going to take over everything. Like, it's going to work so well that it's going to comprehensively cause mass unemployment and murderous computers and everything else, right? And they're both moral panics, right? They're both right. Just extreme emotional reactions to change. And then the actual engineers are like, you know, they're just like show up to work every day, try to get something to work right. Like, they're just trying to make autocorrect on the phone work a little bit better.
I tell you, it's autocorrect is the bane of my existence.
Yeah. So I always tell Elon, it's like, I'm going to get super panicked about AI the minute autocorrect actually works properly. Right. there's a great photo that just went viral on the internet yesterday. The DeepMind guys at Google who do the Go, and everybody's worried about Go is going to extrapolate out into all this stuff. There's a great photo of like those guys trying to present at a conference and they couldn't get the projector to work. Right. they're all standing around the laptop like,
so that's brilliant.
Here in the real world, we're still trying to make
so you don't think we're all going to need to be put onto a universal basic income because we're all going to be out of work and having to fill our time by writing poetry rather than working factories, etc.
Not even a little bit. No.
Because that another thing is like universal basic income. People are getting very excited about this idea.
Yeah.
Especially around here.
Yeah.
But it seems like this is just a kind of a science experiment that people are just, you know, it's a theoretical extrapolation of where we are today, back to your point.
Yeah, or you might call it a fake problem.
Or
a fake problem in the same analogy as fake news. So,
but there is genuine public concern for a lot of people who think about this stuff that we are going to be put out of work by an army of smart machines.
Yeah. So it's Luddites. It's the Luddite fallacy. So it's the time honored. It's literally the Luddite fallacy, and it basically is the Luddite panic, and it basically recurs about every 50 years. If you look historically, there's a new wave of panic. So there's a huge wave of panic around this when computers came out in the 50s and 60s. And if you go back and read the accounts at the time, it's just like automation. Oh my God. Like, it's just, this is all going to be absolutely horrible. And of course, what's happened in the intervening 50 years is the number of jobs in the world are, you know, way up. The number of jobs in the world have skyrocketed since then. The amount of income in the world has skyrocketed since then. And then it's even weird to think about what's actually happening in current events in the U.S. today, right? Which is what we're actually doing is we're sitting here. Actually, the jobs numbers just came out this morning. Unemployment is at a 20-year low in the U.S. It's actually funny to watch the press coverage on this. So the press coverage on this, right, after 2008, the press coverage was, oh, the misery of unemployment, which, by the way, very valid story. Unemployment is a terrible thing. So story after story after story of all these people who can't get jobs. And then, of course, what happens? The economy recovers, and there's been a huge surge of hiring over the last 8 years. Now we're running at a 20-year low in unemployment. The story is immediately flipped to, oh, my God, now look at the horror of all these producers who now can't hire the people. Right. And so the New York Times.
Talent shortage.
What's that?
Talent
shortage, right? And it's like, the stories literally went from, oh my God, job shortage, to oh my God, talent shortage in one step, Right. There was never the story. There was never the story of, you know, actually, we kind of have the right number of workers for the right number of jobs. Like that story, for some reason, I don't know.
That's really boring.
It's probably hung up in editing, is my guess.
Story.
Yeah.
That would get left on the cutting room.
My guess, they're probably still trying to find the right photo to put
above the headline. Probably a cinnamon bun.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, there is no trace of any of this anywhere in the economy. We have this problem right now. We actually don't have enough workers. Like, is the actual problem that we have. And then this also goes to the way to think about the impact of technology more generally on the economy, which is economists have a way of actually measuring the rate of productivity, the rate of technological change in the economy, and it's called productivity growth. And it's something that economists track very carefully. To the extent that you believe that there's some sort of sudden surge in technology innovation that's going to cause massive upheavals in the economy, the number that you would see that in is in productivity growth. And so from the narrative, you would expect productivity growth to be running at these generational highs. What's actually the case is productivity growth is actually at generational lows. We're actually the level
productivity of, growth.
Productivity growth is actually at generational lows. Productivity growth right now is running, it's like 1.5% a year or something. Right, which is like
that sounds very unexciting.
Very unexciting. Contrasted, by the way, productivity growth in the 50s, 60s, 70s was like 3%, 4% a year. And now it's like at 1.5% a year. And so with the actual observed data throughout the entire developed world is actually the rate of technological progress in society in ways that would actually reflect into things like income and into joblessness or job loss is actually much lower. By the way,
that's so much more boring than, oh my God, we're all going to be replaced by machines.
It is. It's much more boring. By the way, another thing people don't – another thing that's very interesting. So if you look at the jobs numbers today, the jobs numbers are always reported in net gains or adds, right? Which is one way to think about it because you're thinking relative to the population of workers. Underneath the net gain and add are two gross numbers, gross job creation in the period and then gross job destruction in the period. And the gross numbers are much higher than the net numbers because the economy changes a lot under normal circumstances. What's interesting is the rate of both job creation and job destruction in the economy over the last 40 years has been falling. The actual rate of structural transformation in the economy is slowing, not rising. By the way, another misperception people have is that people are changing jobs more often. That also turns out not to be true. The rate of job change as measured at the level of the individual is slowing as well. And so
how does the gig economy fit into that?
In terms of these trends, very much on the margin. It's not a big contributor to either one of these things in either direction. It's a new kind of employment option that some people are choosing to do either in addition to a job or they're putting together, a set of these jobs. Well, like one could argue the gig economy should cause these numbers to increase. At least in the data so far, as observed, you can't see that impact. What the numbers show you is economic change is slowing, not accelerating.
The world is revolutionizing before us, but what you're saying is all the numbers are quite pedestrian
right.
and boring.
So here's what I think is happening, because everything we've talked about so far is the economy, right, as if it's one thing. And actually, I think what the important thing actually is it's not one thing. It's actually multiple things. Specifically, the way I think about it is there are now two different kinds of economic sectors. There are two different industries or businesses that you can think about. There are certain sectors where the technological change actually is happening very fast, right? And we could identify a bunch of those. Right? The media, the news and media business generally change is happening very fast. Retail change is now happening very fast. Consumer electronics, right? If you just like what happens like to the pricing capability of television sets, like it's just dramatic what's happening, right? And TV producers go out of business and like all kinds of crazy stuff happens. So like those are three examples of very rapid changing sectors. So by the way, good news, high productivity growth in those sectors. Good news, bad news.
In the media?
Yeah.
Really?
Media productivity has exploded.
Oh, God.
This podcast is going to go, you're going to put this podcast online and it's going to go to... How many people?
Millions of people.
And how much is it going to cost to distribute this podcast to millions and millions of people?
I don't know. What is an hour of your time worth?
Distribution
is nothing.
I'm not charging for this, although we could renegotiate that if you would like. But like what does it cost to distribute audio to, 20 million people today? I mean, we don't even know because it's so small. It's a rounding error. It's like what does it cost to have the lights turned on? Right. I mean, light used to be expensive. Now light's super cheap. Broadcasting audio to 20 million people used to be expensive. Now it's cheap. So productivity growth in the media industry has exploded. Right. And that's causing all kinds of changes. I mean, so there's many new media businesses that are on fire and growing very fast and hiring people. And then there's lots of old media companies that are restructuring and doing layoffs and all these other things. And so that's what you'd expect to see in a sector with rapid productivity growth. And then in the sectors of rapid productivity growth, the other thing you have is the prices are collapsing, right? Which is what you get. The whole point of technology is to do more with less. And so, and then things naturally get cheaper over time. So the price of TVs is collapsing. The price of media is collapsing, right? The price of news has collapsed, which is why the news companies are having such dramatic circumstances. Mm. You know, retail prices are collapsing. You know, the Walmart effect followed by the Amazon effect, right, is causing retail prices to fall. Of course, retail prices falling is great news if you're a consumer, right? Because you're now able to buy more with your dollar. But it's a real fundamental challenge to the producers that are on the wrong side of the cost curve. Okay, so there's those sectors. Then there's the other sectors. Then there are the sectors where there is no productivity growth or maybe even negative productivity growth. And those are sectors called healthcare, education, by the way, construction.
Government.
Government and law generally. And then personal services. And just think as two examples there, childcare and elder care, both big growth industries. So in those sectors, the opposite is happening. There is basically no productivity growth to speak of. There, to the extent technology is getting involved, it's just not moving the needle on the economics really in any significant way, right? And so in those sectors, you see the exact opposite set of effects. You see steadily escalating costs. You see steadily escalating prices, right? And this is why college keeps getting, you know, 10, 15% more expensive every year. It's why health, this is the whole basis of the healthcare debate in the U.S. Healthcare now has inflated to, it's now a sixth of the economy, right? It's now 18% of the economy, and nobody wants to pay for it. But it's the consequence of like massive rise in costs, right? In those sectors, you have the opposite effect happening. Good news, by the way, good news from a job standpoint. Congratulations. Like you want to fully employ everybody in the economy, that we're all going to be employed in these slow productivity growth sectors, right? We're all going to end up being in education, healthcare, because these sectors just need huge numbers of people because there's no productivity growth.
So if for all these journalists going out of jobs, could they go take care of old people?
Well, but there are many others. I mean, look, in all seriousness, like I'll give you an example. Pittsburgh is a great actually example of what's happened, which is like Pittsburgh was like an icon of like old world industrial revolution.
The Steelers.
Yeah, the whole thing. Pittsburgh today is an absolutely thriving hub of healthcare and education, right? It is like ground zero for a tremendous amount of innovation in both of those fields, and like job growth in Pittsburgh is exploding. And so as a regional example, it's actually this kind of transformation playing out. By the way, incomes are way up, like quality of life is way up, like all kinds of things have improved. So that kind of broad-based transformation is happening. But then think about the price impact of what happens then. So in the fast productivity growth sectors, prices are collapsing. In the slow productivity growth sectors, prices are skyrocketing. So think of what happens is the low productivity growth sectors are going to eat the entire economy, right? Because the price of everything where tech is having an impact are on their way to zero.
It's coming down.
The price of everything where tech isn't having an impact, the prices are going to infinity. And so the economy is rotating away from the sectors, just in terms of overall numbers, the economy is rotating away from the sectors where tech's having a big impact and rotating into the sectors where tech is not having a big impact. So then you could say...
Well, tech will follow that great rotation.
Well, we're trying. The problem is that the sectors that have low productivity growth don't just have low productivity growth for no reason. They have low productivity growth for a very specific reason, which is they're incredibly highly regulated. You get this anytime you talk to a founder operating in healthcare or education, which is like if I want to launch a tech startup and I want to go into e-commerce or I want to go into media, like I just do it. If I have a startup and I want to go to healthcare or education, like my...
Different thing.
Yeah, the fun just starts at the point where you develop the product because you've got this incredibly complex nest of regulations, government involvement in these sectors. You've got regulatory capture by the incumbents in the sectors. By the way, you have like in healthcare, you have this other thing. You have this indirect relationship between the customer and the payer, right? Where the customer of the healthcare is not the same person who pays the bills, right? And then the government is deeply involved in the economics of how that works. And so these other sectors, it's not that they're impossible for tech to have a big impact. They're much more difficult for tech to have a big impact. And this is a big thing that's happening in the Valley right now. And we're an example of this, is there's a lot of VCs and entrepreneurs that are now trying to figure out, okay, we need to now go have a bigger impact on education or on healthcare or on construction or on government and law. And I would say, like, we're optimistic, but, like, it's a daunting challenge. But now, the amount of money is gigantic, right?
Yeah.
Healthcare is a sixth of the economy. It's a much bigger sector than most of the sectors that we get involved in. And so if you get your, you know, God-given whatever share of that through technological innovation, like, there's a huge pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. But it's extremely difficult to do it. And I think this is the thing. This is the conundrum at the heart of it, which is... So I would argue, coming from this, like the logical conclusion to me is the problem in today's economy is not that we have too much technological change. The problem by far is that we don't have enough.
Right.
Because if we had more technological change in healthcare and education, construction, government, law, then we could get falling prices in those sectors instead of rising prices in those sectors. And all of us as consumers, everybody who buys any of this stuff, including, you know, directly or indirectly through paying taxes, you know, through taxation and government spending. But because what's the alternative, right?
Right.
Left unchecked, healthcare is going to go from being a sixth economy
to a half,
to a fifth, to a fourth, you know, to a third, to a half. Like, there's no limit on
to infinity and
the
beyond,
scope of this problem. So right, exactly. And, you know, I don't know. Maybe that's what we want, but I think we should aspire to more than that.
Yeah.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Going back to like the big tech companies, I mean, one of the reasons I was sent out here from London is that the five biggest companies in the world, or in the West anyway, are on the West Coast. They're soaking up all of this value from all of these industries that they're disrupting and prices are going down. But are they becoming too powerful?
The read on the Valley from the outside is that we're very smug on this concept of just disruption, because the sort of external view of the Valley is like we're a bunch of kids. We think we can just like walk into any industry and launch these disruptive models.
Correct.
And like not have to worry about the consequences. The number one industry that we try to disrupt is our own industry. 8 out of 10 times, we're not sitting there saying, let's go screw up, you know, I don't know, the car industry or something. 8 out of 10 times, we're saying, let's go try to screw up Oracle. Right. Let's go screw up like, you know, one of these big incumbents. Like, let's go try to take on Google. Let's go try to take on Amazon. Let's go try to take on Apple. And so a huge amount of actually what happens in the Valley, you know, viewed from the outside is sort of much more, I would say, I don't know, incestuous, insular, intramural. We call it intramural sport.
Intramural
sport, right? Yeah. Is basically because they're right here. We see them. We know them. We understand them. The minute they get vulnerable in some way, everybody figures it out. We all know these business models inside out. Many of us participated in building them.
Yeah.
And so the level of internal attack, the amount of energy in the Valley devoted to attacking our champions is much higher than even the level of effort in the Valley devoted to trying to build businesses in these other industries.
But things have become so, tech has become so pervasive that you can't help but disrupt these other industries.
Well, and by the way, there's good and valid reasons to try to do that, in things like healthcare and education. But my point is just that all of the, whatever you think of the big tech incumbents, is not that the entrepreneurial ecosystem of the Valley is saying, oh yeah, they're great, they're our champions, we should let them go on to become very successful. It's the opposite. We get entrepreneurs in here every single day who are just like, you know, yeah, I'm going to go take down Larry Page. Now,
right.
Most of them won't be able to do it, right? By the way, you know, Larry Page was that guy once upon a time, you know, with an idea to taking down Yahoo, and he pulled it off, right? And so, you know, it happens.
Speaking of Yahoo,
right.
I think it's 11 years ago, Yahoo tried to buy Facebook, right, for like $1 billion.
I only know what I've read in the newspaper.
Oh, I read that you told Mark no. And I was just wondering, did you see then what we see now?
You know, again, it's hard to say that you can see. Maybe he had these expectations all along. I mean, it's been so successful, which is a huge credit to those folks, you know, who worked there and built the company. So, I mean, at that stage, it's not so much you're closing your eyes and you're imagining that it's going to be what it is today, because that's hard to do. It's more in a case like that. It's more just looking at like what's the sort of vector of improvement happening at that point. Like you can tell when these companies, sort of think about it as almost like growing strategic value. Like some of it's in the numbers, some of it's like number of users or amount of revenue or whatever, but part of it's just you can feel it if you're up close.
Right.
And if you see enough of these, and it's just basically what happens is these companies are basically either in a positive spiral or a negative spiral at any point in time. And the spiral is kind of comprehensive. It's kind of, the spiral is everything kind of all at the same time. So it's who are you recruiting? who are you retaining or not retaining from your current employee base? What's your morale? What do your customers think of you? How good are your products? What is the press writing about you? All these things. What do investors think about you? It's all kind of the same thing because it all kind of keys off of each other. And so these companies generally, they're either gaining strength kind of in everything all at once, or they're losing strength in everything all at once. And by the way, it changes. Like sometimes they shoot way up and then collapse. Sometimes they go in negative spiral, and then, you know, Apple, they recover and they come out the other side and go. So they do go back and forth. But at any given point in time, you can kind of tell which way they're headed. Generally speaking, if a company is gaining strength, generally speaking, at that stage, selling it is a bad idea. Right, because of the multiplicative effect of just if it just keeps going for 2, 3, 4 more years, the compounding, right, it's compound interest, right? The compounding will create a lot more value than any buyer would be willing to pay. Right. You know, contra that, if you have a company that's in that negative spiral, it's probably a good idea to sell it, you know, kind of at the first available chance because, you know, odds are it's going to keep spiraling. And so I guess it was more of that. It was doing
didn't feel
so
right.
Well. Yeah, no, yeah. It was improving. And by the way, all of these companies, 100% of the time, there are always problems. Like,
yeah, of course.
Right? It's like there's always chaos. Like the amount of – it's the sausage factory metaphor, right? The everybody likes sausage. Nobody wants to see how it gets made.
Yeah.
In these companies, always, no matter how well they're doing internally, there's always some level of stuff happening where you're just like want to pull your hair out. You're just like horrified and like, oh, my God, I can't believe this person's doing that and this and that. And my God, look at this new competitor coming at me, and I can't believe we just lost this engineer. And it's just a nonstop, you know, feels like just this cascade of just horrible things happening.
Yeah.
But you just have to be able to put that in context with the overall trend. And then the other thing is the big macro things that people worry about tend not to be the things that cause huge damage, right? When these companies don't work, it's almost never somebody, you know, Google quashes you or whatever it is. It's almost always you screw something up internally.
You shoot yourself in the foot.
You shoot yourself in the foot, right? It's suicide, not homicide.
Right.
Is the old venture line. And I've just found that, you know, it's like 99 out of 100 times that's the case. And so time spent worrying about these big macro things is almost entirely a waste of time. Contra that, the next hour spent worrying about your internal operations and how good you are at actually running your company, like that has very high payoff.
Right.
And Mark was very serious at that stage and is today about running a great company.
Are you worried about screen time for your child or children generally?
No, not even a little bit.
Why?
There's a great book. There's a great book. So Stephen Johnson, the science writer, who's brilliant, wrote a book a couple years ago called Everything Bad is Good for You. It's a great book. So he goes through the history. There's a history to this. So basically every new form of media that's come out in the last 1,000 years, basically there was a moral panic, and there were basically people who were like, oh my God, this is going to ruin everything. This is going to ruin kids. Like this, it's always going to ruin the kids. Right. And so like Socrates, it started with Socrates, actually. Socrates hated writing. Right. Cause all of Western civilization up to that point was oral tradition. Right.
Yeah.
And so Socrates said that the idea of you write this stuff down, you lose the magic, you lose the effect. And so therefore like Western civilization fell downhill with the invention of the written word. I mean, obviously people hated the introduction of the book, which led to the Reformation, right? Which was the collapse of Western civilization.
Right.
Catholic Church was, let's just say, not a fan.
Yeah.
The novel was viciously attacked for diverting an entire generation of kids away from reading the classics. You know, popular music, jazz was the music of the devil and was going to corrupt an entire generation of kids in the 20s. You know, when I was a kid, TV was rotting our minds. Like, my whole generation was slackers, right? TV was rotting our minds. We were all going to be useless. Heavy metal music was going to make us Satanists. D&D was going to turn us into cult murderers. It's just nonstop. It's just his book goes through in detail the entire history of this. And it always comes out the other end, and it's actually like, actually, those are all pretty good ideas. Like, the culture is actually, I think, better because we have the written word, and we have novels, and we have jazz music, like, actually turned out to be okay.
Yeah.
And even heavy metal is kind of okay. And so this is just more of same.
If you're looking at the internet as a football game, 90-minute football match, what minute are we in?
Which
soccer or football, American football, 60 minutes.
Well, see, in our version of the game, actually people score.
That's fair. I'm on both sides of it, so I can argue either way.
The idea of a really exciting game where the final score is 0-0, like
exciting 0-0, nil-nil game.
There you go. Yeah, we don't have those over here. Sorry, what was the question again?
What minute of the game are we in terms of the evolution?
So by any measure, we're still at the very beginning, just because the cycling, so the combinations. Matt Ridley actually wrote a great book on this topic, where basically it's ideas combining, which is where all the actual progress happens. And so the more ideas there are in the world today, the more ideas there will be in the world in the future because of how they combine.
Right.
And actually, by the way, this is the big unappreciated, I think, effect of the internet in the long run. It's the thing that people are just not tracking closely enough, which is the internet is the best platform anybody's ever come up with to be able to uncover and combine ideas. And that's true, right, in all areas of human activity, all the way from science, all the way through to culture and everything else. And so the rate of improvement of basically everything that we can possibly think about, it's all going to, I mean, notwithstanding our productivity growth discussion we had before, but in general, the growth of ideas is going to accelerate from here.
So we're like minute five.
Oh, yeah, very, very early. Yeah, for sure. Right.
And that is all for another edition of Danny in the Valley. A very big thank you to Mark, who has convinced me to just stop worrying and love the internet. What you can do, of course, is to stop at Apple Podcasts and give us a rating and review. It really does help, so please take a moment and do that. And you can, of course, always find me every Sunday in the Sunday Times online at thetimes.co.uk. And on Twitter at Danny Fortson. Until next week, thank you and bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.